This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and it's Mondays with Boston Mayor Michelle Wu. She is taking our questions and questions you've been sending us through text and social media. We sat down with Mayor Wu earlier today, and we dove right in. Mayor Wu, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. So I want to start, Mayor Wu, with a moment of joy for the city. On Patriots Day, you helped crown the winners of the first Boston Marathon run the way it's supposed to be since 2019. What did you say to the runners, if anything, and what did it mean to you to be part of that?
It was an incredible experience. And, you know, I have watched marathons in the past. I've brought the kids and we cheered them on last October. And it's always emotional standing in those moments where you really see people testing the limits of endurance and strength and just pure resilience and determination on display. This year, it was not only the event back in its full glory, but for me, a look behind the curtain at just how much goes into it. Hours of meetings around public safety and preparedness and event planning. And so to see that all come together was incredibly special.
You know, you make a great point. You've now seen, you know, all kinds of things about how we prepare for a Boston Marathon that the average person can't even imagine. What surprised you most, Mayor Wu, in that look behind the curtain this year about what we do to get ready for this thing?
It's the sheer amount of coordination that happens. Every little detail is mapped out second by second, right? It's not only the stopwatches and the timing of, you know, I started my first BAA 5K by pressing the air horn, which is quite surprising and loud, and you're not quite sure if you're doing it right. And the precision that that moment entails has to start months before. It's zone by zone of police and EMS and fire coordination across not just our agencies here in Boston, but federal agencies and metro area participation and just the amount of volunteers that are involved in the whole thing. It's a testament really to our city and what it means to come together.
Is it something you'd ever want to do? Would you ever want to run the Boston Marathon?
You know, I aspire to the 5K.
Fair enough.
That might be the limit of my aspiration. I, of course, when you're standing there, the thought goes through your mind of how amazing would it be. This year we cheered on several community leaders, and Councilor Lydia Edwards, or now Senator Lydia Edwards, completed her marathon as well. It's amazing to see. And so I'm just as happy cheering on for now.
Fair enough. And I have to admit, I have trouble imagining, even if I were standing at the finish line, that I'd be thinking, I want to do that. But I have terrific respect for people who do. All right, I want to dive into budgets now. And at the top of the hour, I promised listeners that you and I are capable of making budgets interesting. So that's the space I'm going to try to stay in here. You have come out with a new city budget, and it is nearly $4 billion, $216 million more than last year's. That's almost a quarter of $1 billion. Why so much more? What are you trying to do?
You know, the budgets are, in some ways, it seems kind of dry. It's numbers and spreadsheets and department allocations. But really, at the city level, this is how we do everything that touches people's lives. It's the funding for classrooms and teachers and trash pickup and housing supports and our resiliency preparation. So all that we do over the next fiscal year, and our fiscal years start in July and run until the end of June, that is laid out here dollar by dollar, line by line. So it's been really exciting because we are still recovering from the pandemic financially and fiscally as well, but we're in strong shape. And especially relative to other cities, we have the opportunity to put federal funds to work. I really see this whole budget as our Green New Deal roadmap. And we're trying to tie together all the funding sources that we have, the federal recovery dollars, funding and supports from the state government, and our local revenues from various sources to make sure that they're all working together and we're working to tackle these big issues.
So there are a couple of pieces I want to pull out there. And the first is, I noted you just said, you know, this is our Green New Deal roadmap. Much has been made, and the focus feels like it's really on affordable housing in this budget, especially with a $380 million allocation there. So connect the dots for me between this big push in this allocation on affordable housing and this Green New Deal roadmap.
Yeah, the Green New Deal, and particularly how we wrote and planned and researched a local Green New Deal for Boston, is broad and expansive. It requires that we're looking ahead and making the best decisions for our future, which as a baseline means stabilizing our communities and building a welcoming city for everyone right now. And so just as important to a Green New Deal are building tree canopy and improving stormwater retention, but also making sure that we're creating enough housing for people to live in Boston and to benefit from the improvements here. That new housing must be affordable, energy efficient, wherever possible, include our targets for emissions reductions as well. And so this is all interconnected, and our original Green New Deal did showcase how housing stability and economic opportunity and racial equity are the bedrock of our Green New Deal, right along with how you traditionally think about climate resiliency.
So I want to stay on that for a second. On Wednesday night, I'm going to be moderating a forum with two of the gubernatorial candidates, Amora Healy and Sonia Chang Diaz, at WBUR City Space. It's co-sponsored by the Environmental League of Massachusetts. We invited all four candidates. Those two are coming. What is a question you're a voter and a steward of a huge city in Massachusetts. What question do you want to know from our gubernatorial candidates about their climate and energy platforms?
I'm very excited that both candidates have released quite impressive platforms and plans when it comes to climate. I want to hear a sense of urgency and impatience, and a sense that we are willing to go to the mat to chase down even more resources. It's well and good to make plans that go out to the year 2040, 2050. We need to be seeing action right now, and cities need help and support. We are able at the local level to map out exactly where the water is threatening our communities, to quantify what it means when we have diesel school buses driving through our neighborhoods with our most precious cargo of our young people on board. We're able to make a short and small investment in piloting some of these initiatives, whether it's fare free public transportation or purchasing 20 school buses out of our, as we begin to replace our fleet of 700. But we need major commitments from the state level to continue chasing federal resources and to ensure that the dollars will flow down to municipalities. So I'm curious how much they're willing to put directly into these plans, and how they can help coordinate among municipalities across the region and the state to ensure that we're working together on this.
Okay, thank you for that. Let's pick up on that reference to federal resources, and I want to come back to the affordable housing piece of your budget. It is a big spend, $380 million allocation. It isn't over just 1 year. It's over multiple years. My understanding is there's a chunk of more than $200 million in that that is American Rescue Plan money. So first, am I correct about that?
That's correct. $206 million of our federal American Rescue Plan allocation, plus capital funding from our capital budget, which goes to direct infrastructure investments, plus some operating funds to run programs as well.
Okay, so two follow-up questions there. First, if it's $206 million, how much ARPA, American Rescue Plan money, is available after that, if this much is going to this core issue of affordable housing?
So the quick math is that the city had received about $560 million of ARPA dollars. A chunk of that, about a fifth of that, has already gone to replacing holes in our budget over the last 2 years, and what we anticipate will be another set of needs over the next year and 2 years. And so all told, we have about $350 million unallocated of ARPA funds. 206 going to housing, and a big chunk going to economic equity and inclusion, another big chunk for climate resiliency focus, for arts, for a big elevation of mental health as a citywide priority, as well as early education and childcare, and ensuring that we're also reserving some for COVID response should it be needed headed into next fall and winter.
There's always more than one thing, right? A budget is broad, but we are talking about housing and affordable housing now. What is the single most important pain point that you are trying to tackle right now as mayor when it comes to housing and affordable housing in the city?
There are four. let me try to prioritize. I guess what I can say is that housing is subject to forces beyond the city's control, right? It's traditionally been seen as a state or even federal issue. And much of the public housing that we see in Boston today came from a time when the federal government was willing to spend a significant amount of dollars to build and maintain this housing. And that commitment has waned over decades. And now we're stuck in a place where much of that is falling down to the local level. So our priorities are to do what we can at the city level, first of all, to make sure that we are creating new affordable housing, again, that's energy efficient and green wherever possible. Another chunk to increasing home ownership so that we're closing the racial wealth gap. And then working to make sure that we are smoothing and simplifying our processes so that the soft cost, how long it takes to move affordable housing through the system, can actually go down.
Yeah. So what are the timetables on some of these things, Mayor Wu? I mean, budgets are an annual cycle. We are talking about long-term systemic issues that have stymied the city and, as you say, are not fixable just by city policy. How long do you think it is before you see the needle really move, let's say, on affordable housing stock? What's the fastest you think it's possible to move the needle on that?
We need to move the needle every day. In some ways, the beauty of the federal funds is that it is a much needed infusion, but there's also a time clock on them. They will disappear if they're not used or if they're not allocated within two or so years and then used up by the year or two after that. And so we are moving with urgency. Every single month, there are projects coming before the city that need a little bit of support just to ensure that we can create more affordable housing. And so those dollars have already been going out the door, whether it is rental assistance or keeping people in their homes or helping to finance affordable housing developments that otherwise can't quite make the numbers work. And so there's tremendous need. The real question with our federal recovery dollars is how do we make sure that we're not just temporarily plugging holes in a leaky bucket, but really changing systems and seeing lasting impact.
Let's stay on rent for the last question on this. A recent report by the listing site Zumper found that rents across Greater Boston jumped about 30% this year, which is, it's a lot. I know you support the overall idea of rent stabilization, but what kind of money transfer can you do right now? What's the bolus that you can do to help people coming up short on rent? Is there new money there for that?
So, in fact, the state did extend the pool of funds that are available for residents who need rental assistance. They replenished that and have continued some protections. So there is still support in this moment. Again, it is in some ways treading water for renters because prices still continue to go up. There's so much that people are facing right now. Rent is very much connected to the availability of housing. It's connected to what we're permitting in terms of new housing. It's also connected to transportation and where the jobs are. And so we are working on all those fronts to be coordinated and to have a regional collaboration on this. And so I'm very excited to be working with the Metro Mayors Coalition and co-chairing alongside with Mayor Arrigo, a group that's going to specifically focus on housing.
Okay, we're going to go to a break in just a second. But before I do, just a quick lightning round question. You have a piano in your City Hall office. What are you playing?
Well, actually, I've been practicing because I had offered to, I meant to put out there that it's been a while since I've accompanied young people playing, and a local organization finally took me up on it. So I'm going to be performing with them soon. So we're practicing somewhere over the rainbow.
Oh, no, no, no. You have to tell me, how old is the student you're going to be accompanying and what instrument are they playing? Do you know? I'm imagining like a recorder or something like that.
No, no, I think it's a larger group. I believe it's singers and a mix of age ranges.
I'm going to jump right in to a Twitter question for you. Twitter user Matthew Savage asks, are you going to consider acting police commissioner Gregory Long for the permanent job, Mayor Wu?
I have had extensive conversations with the commissioner and I'm really grateful for his partnership, his leadership of the department. He has said he's not interested. There is a process ongoing now and anyone is actually applications just opened. So we have consolidated the feedback from many public conversations and stakeholder conversations into a job description. And we're encouraging anyone to apply. Unfortunately, the commissioner has said he's not interested and he's been helping to steer this process right now.
So you've set a deadline of May 13th to apply. Do you have eyes in? Do you have any idea how that's progressing? Are you aware of where the candidate pool stands now and how many people are applying?
I do not have that information. The search committee of five incredible community leaders has selected a search firm to help partner. A big part of this is that we want to attract and welcome the best applicant pool possible. Confidentiality is a big piece of that as well. So I haven't even had an eye into numbers or certainly names of who's put their name forward.
Yeah, so that's actually an interesting question. Is there some kind of firewall there on purpose because of the way you do or do not want to influence the process? Or is it just that you just haven't seen yet?
I have not seen yet, and I want to be very mindful of how we are ensuring confidentiality of all of our applicants. And so I'll trust the search firm and their expertise on this front, as well as our search committee.
So in your budget, you call for a roughly 1% reduction to the Boston Police Department. I want to ask you about that number. Some police reform advocates were dismayed that it was seemingly small. Does it feel small to you? What are you scaling back? And what didn't you scale back that maybe a year ago, before you were mayor, you thought you might?
You know, what I have really tried to push us away from in this budget cycle is focusing on dollar amounts and percentages as if that is impact in and of itself. Because at the end of the day, it's really about what happens from those dollar amounts. And so $380 million might sound like a large number for affordable housing, but we got there by building up from the ground up the amount of need and impact that we expect each subcategory of that to deliver. And same thing when it comes to staffing levels, or in this case, the police budget. In some ways, picking a number to say we were going to cut the budget by 10% or 5%, we've done that in recent years. And what ends up happening is it comes out of the overtime line item because everything else is personnel and it's tied to contracts and collective bargaining. And so you can't immediately shift things without addressing the union contracts. And so you can get a 10% cut by decreasing the overtime line item. But what we know is that is in some ways a farce. The amount of overtime paid depends on the hours worked, not what's laid out in the budget. They are guaranteed by law to get paid every hour of overtime granted. And so rather than create a shell game where we're presenting a certain number that won't pan out, you know, we've blown past the overtime line item now multiple years in a row. We are really trying to institute the structural and programmatic items that we want to see happen this year, especially as the police commissioner search is ongoing. And so we're making changes to crisis response and to build up our cadet classes and recruitment so that we could diversify the workforce here and across the city. And that's where we'll see change.
Okay, so two more quick questions on policing. First, I'm sure you're aware of Boston Globe reporting that the records they obtained show the city's new police watchdog, the Office of Police Accountability and Transparency, has looked into 5 complaints so far, not finished on those. The executive director, Stephanie Everett, was put in place at the beginning of last May, so it's been about a year. Was there a benchmark or a threshold of number of complaints? Was there a metric that was set for that office for its first year accomplishments, and how does where it is stack up against that?
Director Everett is, she's a fighter. She is going to make sure that this office has the resources and the authority that it needs. We have been affected in implementation just from various transitions over the last year and a half or so. And when I came into office, I was the third mayor in 12 months. And it wasn't until a few months after that, that we had the Civilian Review Board fully seated and the Internal Affairs Oversight Panel fully seated. Both groups had their orientation just about a month and a half ago. And so they're still getting ramped up, but they are getting there. And I anticipate seeing that caseload tick up, one, as they are fully staffed up, but two, also as that staffing allows them to get out into the community to ensure that our residents know that this new oversight mechanism exists and then can reach out.
So there is a new ordinance restricting officers' use of tear gas and projectiles like rubber bullets for crowd control. Police unions last week wrote you a letter asking you to clarify your position about it. We spoke to Patrick Bryant, who's the general counsel to the Boston Police Superior Officers Federation. Here he is. He says the rules are more about politics than public safety.
The concern is that the decision is not being made in terms of what is effective or what is appropriate for police to be able to use, as opposed to, say, what is more expedient.
So saying that the choice to restrict those things was not about efficacy, how do you respond to that? And are you having conversations with the unions in response to the letter?
There is an incredible amount of planning and preparation and training that goes into every single moment of our officers serving the city. I saw, again, a taste of it and the marathon preparations, and know that large-scale events in particular are very high stakes for our officers and their families, as well as for everyone who's present. And so we, as a baseline, need to ensure safety for those attendees at the event and for our officers. This is not a decision that's being made. It's a decision that has been made through our democratic process. Our city council, and I was part of the council as the deliberations were happening, has taken a vote, and this is an ordinance that is in place. There's opportunity for anyone to revisit legislation if they want to submit new amendments or legislation. But as it stands, this ordinance was already very thoughtful when it comes to how the measures were implemented. It's a significantly different form than when it was first introduced, and it involves giving a warning to crowds before using potentially dangerous chemicals or projectiles at large-scale events. These are items that in other parts of the world are not allowed for use at all. And so this strikes a balance of ensuring that we can protect everyone's safety at the events.
So lots of questions came in over the weekend from users in social media, and many of them were focused on COVID. And we are in a new moment with the subvariants of Omicron that are spreading. So I want to ask you a few of those. This is from Evan George on Twitter. It says, last winter, your administration outlined three metrics for when the city would lift its public health measures around COVID. Since we are no longer in compliance with one of them, can you clarify, is the city still using these metrics? And if not, what metrics are we now using? And just for listeners, I believe he's talking about the community positivity rate, which now stands at about 6.8%, which is above the 5% threshold, Mayor Wu.
That's right. At the time, we specified that these three metrics would be used in concert with each other, because we need to watch not only the spread of the virus in communities, but also the impact that it's having on our healthcare system with the ICU capacity and hospitalization rates from the virus. What we have seen is that as community transmission rates have ticked up, at least with the testing that's available, so far hospitalization has not crossed the other thresholds that have been set. And so those have been the thresholds that we use to define when we're in a surge, when all three are met. And so we're watching this very closely. There are promising signs from the wastewater data, which has now shown a bit of a decline over successive days. And so we're monitoring every bit of information that we have and working to make sure that that is reflected in the policymaking.
Okay, lots of questions about schools and masks and COVID. I'm going to give you a representative one. This was from the user Smarty Pants. When can the masks come off at BPS? Windows can be open now. This is just getting so tiresome. Many other districts have had a voluntary mask policy for 1 year. Truly sucks for our kids, end quote. And again, that's a quote from Twitter. How are you thinking about schools and masking right now? And what metrics are you looking at to make that decision?
Yes, I know this has been incredibly, incredibly difficult for our families, for school communities throughout this pandemic, because it's felt not only like we are in situations that have unknown health consequences at times, but also that the process of changing protocols has lurched from surge to surge. And so most of all, we need to ensure that our young people and their health, well-being, their physical health, their mental health is driving the decision-making. I spend some time each week in schools, just was at a school visit earlier today, and send my two boys off to our schools every day as well. And so I think about the toll that this is taking, understand the fatigue, understand the desire to just move on. Boston Public Schools has pretty big vaccination gaps when it comes to our young people. And that has factored into our decision-making as well, especially relative to other districts. We are watching the numbers very closely. We are working to balance every bit of the public health knowledge and information with the needs of schools and school leaders on the ground. Some school leaders have told me they're perfectly comfortable and believe the student population is more comfortable ensuring that people can be safe. Other school leaders have said, it's time to make a change. And so we're watching this data very, very carefully. Again, wastewater data now slightly on the decline, hoping that continues, and hospitalizations rising slightly. And so we just need to make sure that we're monitoring this, especially after school vacation, and come to something that can really ensure we're protecting all of our young people.
All right. Now for some truly important prognostication. The Celtics play the Nets 7 o'clock tonight. It is the fourth game. They're up 3-0 in the series. Putting you on the spot, what do you think? Do they sweep it, or are the Nets going to make a dying gasp with a win tonight?
The last three games have been so exciting, and the Celtics are playing incredibly, incredibly well. I don't want to jinx anything, but I feel good about where we are. And sometimes there's a little bit of, well, let's have them do it at home, it'll be great. But no, we just need to get it done, and then we can move on to the next phase.
You'd rather they get it done tonight than get it done at home.
Absolutely. We want it in hand.
All right. Boston Mayor Michelle Wu, we appreciate you continuing to join us on Mondays with the mayor. I know we're looking forward to talking to you again next month. Thanks for the time today, and enjoy this spring weather.
You too. Always great to be with you.
It is a gut punch. It is. It's a gut punch to hear and see the news and the images coming out of Ukraine 2 months into this war. It's hard not to feel helpless. Well, Steve Nooki Postal, chef and founder of Commonwealth in Cambridge and Revival Cafe and Kitchen, which has locations in Cambridge and Somerville and Boston, wanted to help. So he went. He went to the Polish border with Ukraine and did what he does best. He cooked. Not for restaurant patrons, but for refugees. He came back about a week ago, joins us now. Nooki, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, to call you Chef Nooki, is that all right?
That's fine.
All right, so for our listeners who aren't familiar with the World Central Kitchen, which is the organization that you went and cooked with, tell us about the organization and its work, how it functions in these situations.
I mean, an amazing organization, the World Central Kitchen, not really getting involved in political or what's happening. It's if there's a humanitarian need where people need to be fed, they go, whether it's an earthquake or a tornado or, the situation that's happening right now in the Ukraine. An amazing, amazing organization.
So you go there, you connect with them, you go to Shemeshal, which is on the Ukrainian border, you're in Poland. I've seen some of the pictures just of the magnitude, Chef Nookie, of what happened there every day to feed people. Can you describe some of that for us?
Sure. I mean, it's an unbelievable undertaking to, they built this. This happened before I got there, but basically an abandoned airplane hangar and turned it into a fully functioning kitchen with a walk-in and bathrooms and areas for trucks to deliver. And there's forklifts coming in and going out and food coming in and going out. We were producing food for, as much as we could produce. That's how much the need is.
So give us, I saw a picture at one point of a number of bananas, which I cannot conceive of it, being peeled into this. I mean, these bowls are like the size of a large industrial satellite dish.
Yeah,
what kind of quantities are we talking about?
We're talking massive quantities. We were using these huge, huge paella pans, and we would use them for giant mixing bowls if we were making bread pudding or banana bread. We would be doing goulashes and stews. We'd use them to cook hot chocolate. Each one of those paella pans would feed around 1,200 people per pan.
Did you have any contact with the people you were feeding?
Where the kitchen is slightly away from where it goes out. It's kind of the hub, and then it ships out to all the different locations. I did take a trip to one of the locations, and it was it's what you see. It's not great.
What sticks out in your mind?
You know, it's the people and the children, and it's mostly women and kids, and these people have nowhere to go and nothing, only what they could carry. There was plenty of food for them once they got there. That felt good, but just not a great situation. People coming and people going back in.
You have kids. You have a family. What was that conversation like? I'm gonna go to the border of a war zone to feed people.
Yeah, I have three kids and a wife, and honestly, their biggest concern was, who's gonna make dinner? Is mom's gonna make dinner?
How'd that go?
They went great. She did awesome. But I think they all understood why I was going. And I think they were proud of me for going. And, I was nervous and scared and excited. And there were a lot of emotions. But I'm really glad I did it.
What was your scariest moment and what was the most satisfying moment?
I think once I first, just getting there, everything is different. I don't speak Polish. And, the signs are in Polish or in Russian. Just getting there, just driving over there and trying to navigate and find my lodging and then find the kitchen. And that was the hardest part. And I think once I got there and found this community and started cooking food and watched it, started going out, 1,000 people, 500, 300, 200, that felt really good.
Were there other chefs there from other parts of the world?
Yeah, there were people from all over the place. I met, and not only chefs, people. I met a dentist who had just retired, and 2 days later he came to Poland to help, and he was building sandwiches for days. There were people from New York and Spain and France and just everywhere. And it was an amazing group of people, everyone there to help and to just do whatever they can to help these people.
So I was thinking about this when I was reading more about, your trip there. I have respect for all levels of culinary skill. You bring an elite level of culinary skill as a chef, and I wonder, were there interesting or surprising ways to bring the skill set that a chef has into that mix and use it there? And if so, how?
I think for this specific situation, the skill set that probably my best was the fact that I'm able to cook volume. And it was all about volume. However much we could produce, whatever was the most efficient way to produce the most amount of food is what we wanted to do.
And what's different about cooking volume, Chef Nookie?
It's just a lot. It's a lot of chopping. It's a lot of onions. It's a lot of peppers. It's just a lot of volume. It's a lot of lifting. After my first day, I lifted so many boxes, and it's just a lot of volume, and you need power to just you know, put it into containers and forklift it over and you know, get another batch going. It took three people just to lift the pan to go clean it.
Were you exhausted at the end of that first day?
Oh, yeah, I was hurting for sure. You know, from like, you know, right now I'm not doing 17-hour days working on my feet in a giant warehouse. So it was a little bit of a body shock for me, but I got used to it, and it felt really good because it was like we were doing such good things, so the hours weren't that terrible.
Why'd you go? At the end of the day, why'd you really go?
I mean, the reason I initially went was I was just so upset about how the government has treated small, local, independent restaurants through this pandemic by not refilling the RRF. And I was sitting there like wallowing.
Restaurant Relief Fund.
Exactly. I was sitting there wallowing in my own self-pity. And then I saw this war started, and I was just like, you know what? I'm going to go. I'm going to go. I talked to my wife. I'm going to go. I got to do something. I can't just sit here and think about how the government basically completely lied to us and told us one thing and did something else.
Why do you say the government lied to you?
Well, they passed this RRF, which was going to say, you know, save all the restaurants. These are how you apply. I applied. I was approved. And then I got nothing.
And that was for Commonwealth, right?
Correct.
And did you know other restaurateurs who did get money?
Yeah, I know some that got money, and it was really helpful for them. And, you know, just the upsetting thing is, you know, the government took credit. They took pictures with the chefs and shook hands, and they saved everything, but they just didn't deliver the money. And then we told them, and they still are just unable to do anything about it. So it made me feel really not great about our country, our government, the way the Senate works. And I just needed to get out, and I needed to go help some people, and that's what I did.
So now that you've done that, and you've seen how the U.S. government is making decisions about the war in Ukraine, the Russian invasion there, how do you feel now?
I thought I was going to feel better. I feel still the same. I still feel angry. I mean, there is talk of them this week, standalone bill. The House did pass something while I was in Poland to get some fund, to fund everyone who was told they were going to get money that didn't get any. But I have little to no faith in them.
And that bill, just to note, was supported by many members of the Massachusetts delegation. I admit I don't know off the top of my head if it was supported by all of them.
It was.
Yeah. So what do you do now? Where do you channel? I mean, that was an incredibly brave, dangerous, philanthropic, creative way to channel your energies. I guess, do you want to go back? And if not, what's the next way you channel yourself to help people?
So I really did enjoy that experience. I'm not going back to Poland. I have no plans on going back to Poland. But I do, and I have been in communications with the World Central Kitchen on their next activation, that I will more than likely go to that, whether that is a hurricane or whatever comes next, because there's always something next. I'll go there and help that.
And I want to say, sorry for that mic noise. My mic boom came down a little bit while we were talking there.
You know, I love being in studio, so it's great. It's wonderful. I love seeing that.
Excellent, excellent. All right, so listen, my last question. Yes. If you go again, and God forbid there's a need, but we know there will be at some point, what will you do differently, or what will you bring with you, or what will you want to do next time now that you've done this once?
No question, I'd bring better footwear.
Oh, no, that was not what I was expecting. So now you have to explain that.
Well, it was just, you know, it was a lot of working, and it was 17 hours, and I really wanted my work shoes, and I didn't have my clogs, and I wish I had my clogs.
What did you have instead?
I just had these sneakers, and they were slipping all over the place, and I felt like a noob, and better footwear for sure. But I'll definitely be going next time, whenever that is. Hurricane season's coming, and I'm not looking forward to it, but I am I enjoyed the experience.
And best piece of food or recipe or item that you prepared while you were there?
Oh, we made one of the volunteers, we got a giant pallet of beets, and we made enough borscht for about 3,000 people. That was amazing.
Did you get to try it? Was it good?
Oh, yeah, it was great. It was one of the volunteers' grandmother's recipe. but we had to multiply it by like 300.
Fantastic. All right. Chef Steve Nookie Postal is a local chef and restaurateur. He is the founder of Commonwealth in Cambridge and Revival Cafe and Kitchen, which has locations in Cambridge, Davis Square, and on Newbury Street in Boston, back from Ukraine's border, cooking for other people. Chef Nookie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Staying with Ukraine now, a 2-year-old and a 17-month-old from Ukraine have new hope, thanks to Shriners Hospital. The little ones both had accidents at home that led to severe burns, over 40 to 70% of their bodies. And with a war raging, they couldn't get critical care at home. They are here now, flown via Poland for specialized care and surgery, and they'll have additional surgeries later this week. Dr. Robert Sheridan is a trauma surgeon and head of burn services at Shriners, which is the only center exclusively for pediatric burns in New England. He's treating the children. He joins us now. Dr. Sheridan, welcome.
Well, hello. Thank you.
Glad to have you, and I want to be respectful of patient confidentiality, but also, you know, have genuine concern for these two children. Can you tell us how they're doing?
Yeah, I mean, they're both on track as we would want them to be. I like you, I want to respect their confidentiality, so we'll have to avoid specifics, but so far they're on track, and they're following the usual trajectory of getting the dead material off their wounds and cleaning up their wounds, and then we'll begin grafting them later this week.
So my understanding is that the children were not burned in an attack, so in an act of war, but that one of their cases was related to the war. Can you tell us anything about what happened to them?
Well, both were boiling water accidents, and which are common, and one was, I think, caused by some panic and confusion during a bombardment, but was not directly caused by the bombardment.
When you say boiling water burns are common, certainly, you know, as a parent, that makes me recoil. I'm sure there will be a lot of listeners who say, wait a minute, how common is that? And how bad is it when that happens to a kid?
Well, you know, we, excuse me, one sec.
I understand that you're in a hospital environment,
yeah,
so,
sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry. We see a lot of scalding water injuries and cooking accidents and bathing accidents related to hot water, hot foods. The severity is usually related to, you know, how little the child is and how big the wound is. And in these cases, they're both little kids with bigger wounds.
So I think about this, doctor. You know, I have no experience in a war zone, and I have no experience working with little ones who have burns. I have to imagine the complexity of getting them here, transporting them while so badly injured, helping their families. What can you tell us about what it took to get them here and begin treatment?
Well, our hospital here has a lot of experience with moving kids from far away to obtain care in the burn unit and supporting families along the way. I'm thankful that to be part of that team that has that infrastructure evolved to do that. We work a lot with other charitable organizations, and in this case, Ukrainian American organization that we've been working with for, you know, quite a few years, bringing kids here on a regular basis for more severe injuries from the Ukrainian National Unit. And we basically, it was that same, those same relationships were used to make arrangements for these kids, although there was the additional complexity of not being able to fly them from Ukraine. We had to, they had to be ground ambulanced to a facility in Poland and held in Poland while the arrangements were made for a flight from Poland.
Did they have any trouble getting out of the country?
You know, I'd have to defer that question to my colleague, Gennady Fuzilov, who made those arrangements or worked together with the Ukrainians to make those arrangements. There were certainly some visa passport type issues, but they were relatively quickly facilitated via our home office in Tampa, Florida. And just the logistics of, you know, safely getting a ground ambulance out. So there were these transfers were delayed by some days longer than we would typically see.
Yeah, how long did it take for the children to arrive here? And do you have concerns about complications with their injuries given the time?
Well, you know, we talked to the providers there who are taking care of them, and there are things you can do to delay definitive closure of the wounds. And so those maneuvers were very well done by the guys there. And but, you know, the delays do sometimes carry infectious consequences because this is really, you know, sort of a race against the inevitable infection. But you can delay it with antibiotics and excisional debridement of wounds and sort of removing as much of the dead tissue as you can before they make the transit.
I understand Shriners Care is 100% free for children, including the transport. You support families. Are you able to tell us where their families able to accompany them?
There was a mom came with each child, and they are being housed by the organization here, and they can stay bedside also. We're a very open unit.
And how do you think about someone going home after this? When I'm assuming it's a long process to help these kids be well again, how do you think about them going back? You know, especially you are a retired colonel in the U.S. Army. You trained with the Army in surgery and with their burn unit in San Antonio and at Walter Reed. How do you think about that?
Well, you know, we try to look at this as kind of a long continuum of care from the time of the initial encounter, initial, you know, flurry of critical care and wound closure, but then looking at getting the kids back to as normal an existence as possible back home. And so it's a relationship doesn't end when they go home. We have regular communications. We bring the kids back for reconstruction. Some of the littler kids will need quite a lot of reconstruction as they outgrow their initial result. And the hospital's been able to do that. The Shriners have been great. They have funded a sort of an infrastructure of people and equipment to allow, and housing to allow families to make those back and forth trips for return visits for ongoing reconstruction.
That's good news. All right, Dr. Robert Sheridan, Burn Unit Director of Shriners Hospital for Children. Thanks so much for your work and for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much. Take care.
And that is our show for today. Listeners, we'd love to hear your thoughts about the show. Text us. You can get started by texting 617-766-0382, or you can go to radioboston.org/about to sign up there. That's our show for today. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.